1997 de Chétiquin, Sylvia Lelièvre, qui est l'auteur de ce...
Hi, this is Marshall Dibo, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, John Abbott on the Air. I'm joined by Barbara Gunaratduni Dibo. Barbara is Ganyage Haga, or Mohawk, of mixed heritage, originally from Ganawagi, and now living in Montreal. She is currently the artist, director, and choreographer of Anowara Dance Theatre. An award-winning choreographer and dancer for over 25 years, she takes pride in sharing her culture and has performed across Canada and internationally. She was one of the 8 dancers in North America invited to perform at Gathering of Nations New Mexico, the world's largest powwow, in its first ever hoop dance competition in 2015. Barbara also works with various organizations to help educate, help create safe spaces, and support Indigenous artists across the globe. Her goals are to inspire others, encourage cultural pride, uplift the spirit, and increase education and communication. And she also happens to be my mother. Hi, Mom. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. So we're going to jump right into this. I wanted to start off. Could you tell me about your work and how would you describe your profession?
Okay. I would describe my work as, well, I am a Indigenous choreographer and dancer, and I specialize in highlighting Indigenous themes, styles, often mixed with other mainstream sorts of dance. And I always create stories through my dance about Indigenous culture and stories that need to be told, I believe.
Awesome. Okay, so I want to get into a kind of timeline of your dance career. So starting off, what or who got you into dance?
Wow, I guess I would have to say my mother got me into dance. She had danced in her life, so she had an interest in it, and she put me in classical ballet at a very young age. So I guess I started classical ballet when I was about 4 years old, and I loved it, and I kept going, and then eventually I started discovering other forms of dance, because I grew up in a really small town, a farm community, so we didn't have much access to various styles of dance, so to say. So when I moved to Montreal to study theater, actually, I took a lot of dance on the side, where I discovered like modern dance and contemporary ballroom, different hip hop styles, and of course powwow dancing.
Awesome. I find it really interesting that you said that like your mother was the one who kind of got you into dance, because it's the same situation for me. And you were also speaking about different styles you've trained in. Is there any that you prefer?
Wow. Well, I'm always training, because I feel like there's so much you can learn in dance. And I like to have a wide vocabulary, dance vocabulary, to draw from to be able to express what I want to on stage. Because, you know, sometimes more of a lyrical balletic movement might express one thing, whereas like a hip hop movement might do something else, and a powwow something else. So I currently still train, and mainly I train kind of in hip hop styles now, because I really like that. And when I was younger, I didn't have the opportunity to learn these styles, and I really wanted to. So I'm a bit of a late bloomer in that. But that's one thing that I still take classes on. And I'm always learning more and more, of course, about our cultural dances. So Iroquois social dancing, learning more of those, and also going deeper into the powwow dance stories, origins, and styles as well.
Great. You were speaking before about how you grew up in a small town. When you were starting off your career in the dance world, first of all, was that more when you moved back to Montreal?
Yeah, well, I was really naive and inexperienced when I moved to Montreal, and I guess I had a bit of a rude awakening of how competitive the dance world could be, and realized that perhaps don't know, sufficient training in certain styles, but I always say that my naive enthusiasm got me far. So I would always jump into every opportunity that I would have around dance. But I guess only recently, I would mean I would be hired as a dancer here and there, but only recently I see a real change in perhaps the last 10 years of people taking an interest in indigenous style dances on main stages. You know, I mean, we've always danced in powwows in our communities, but now I see there is a bit of a shift where big theaters, arts organizations, funders are beginning to support more indigenous dance. So I guess there's been more of an interest and support system for my style of dance, which I'm really grateful for. And I'm trying to use that to be able to hopefully inspire other, you know, young indigenous dancers, choreographers that you can see that it can be done. You can do it. There is space for us. There always has been, and we still have to keep pushing for that.
It's great that you're saying now there's like a real support system around indigenous dancers and all that.
Well, yeah, there's a support, but we still have work to do. I do have to point that out.
At the start of your career, did you have anyone who was supporting you and inspiring you?
Well, I mean, there's always ups and downs throughout any career, I suppose, and artists, it's you have your ups and downs, but you know, there's like some significant people or moments, I guess, that kind of propelled me to keep going. Of course, my mom, well, my parents, they were always supportive of my dance interest. So even when I wanted to be an artist as an adult, they didn't say, "Oh my gosh, that's not a real job." they were supportive of it. So that was always helpful to have that that attitude surrounding me to start with. I had like my first real ballet teacher. She, Jennifer Verfaley in Nova Scotia, she taught me some really good basics of the ballet world and discipline and working hard. And she still comes to my dance shows now when she can. So I think I want to make her proud still. and then when I went and studied, I actually studied theater at Concordia University. And that was a great learning experience because it really taught me to take risk to say, you know, I'm going to take this chance to make a fool of myself on stage in front of everyone, but it's okay. The world doesn't fall apart. So that allowed me, because I always say in dance, we're kind of comfortable in discomfort. Like we're always trying to push our horizons and our moves and our everything. So we're always like kind of in an uncomfortable thing. We're not in like a steady stay, always in the same place. So that taught me that, Concordia. And then I went to a place called the National Theatre School. And that was in Ontario. And it was a summer program where we lived on a farm and rehearsed in a barn. And we did that for a month. It was like youth in their 20s, Indigenous youth from across Canada. And we did theater, and we did a little tour for a month too on different reserves. But it was the first time that I was really taught and shown that I could mix my culture and my art together. Because not only did we do theater, but we did like learning powwow dancing and powwow singing and had sweat lodges and learned about different ceremony. And that really nourished me in a way that opened up a whole new world, a whole different way of looking at my dance career, of my dance approach, my dance perspectives. So I think that was really pivotal for me to basically live more of our cultural approach for dance instead of the mainstream dance world, which, like I said, seems very kind of judgmental and competitive sometimes. This was a way of just saying, you know, dance is good. Dance is me. I can do dance, and it's good medicine, like we say. So that's kind of how I live my career now. I try to use those values and perspectives for everyone involved.
Yeah. And speaking of your career now, What do you find really inspires you these days? Where are you taking inspiration from?
Wow. Well, that changes all the time, but I often just look to our stories and my community, because there's so much beauty and value and important things that we can learn through our culture that it really inspires me. And I think it can be really helpful for the general public. So I often will take these things and make dance around that. So I guess that's often what inspires me now.
Yeah. And speaking of taking inspiration from current day things and your culture, tell me about a current project that you've been working on.
Well, I guess the latest project, it's quite a big project. It's a dance piece that I choreographed called Sky Dancers, and it has just been shown. Its premiere was at Place des Arts through Festival Cartier Danse. And I believe I'm the first Mohawk choreographer ever to be shown at Place des Arts, which is like awesome. and I'm glad that I had that platform to share. It's a story. Well, Sky Dancers is basically inspired and tells the story through dance of the Quebec Bridge disaster of 1907. And when the bridge was being constructed in near Quebec City, it fell. It fell during construction due to errors that the engineer made. And he wasn't listening to the workers saying, oh, something's wrong here. And 76 iron workers died that day when the bridge collapsed. And 33 of them were Mohawk from Ganawagi. And a lot of people don't know that side of the story of how much that affected our community, how it affected the world of building and engineering. And when I was talking to different community members about the families that remember their ancestors who died that, and in fact, my great-grandfather was one of the iron workers. Your great-great-grandfather was one of the iron workers who died on the bridge that day. So it was a story that was touching me personally, but the more and more I heard the stories of the people, of other families that are around that subject, it was so interesting. It just really put a human face on this story and made it kind of a universal themes that people can relate to. And I thought it was such an important story to tell about the contributions we made and how we survive, our resilience, our strength, and all that through tragedy. So yeah, it's about an hour long, and there's 8 dancers on stage. Sometimes we have live musicians, and so far it's been really well received.
That's awesome. Yeah. What was the hardest part in creating this show? Because you're talking a lot about how much work was put into this, and, you know, it seems you really poured your soul into this project. What was something that you really struggled with when you were making this?
Part of it was just having confidence in myself that I could make a show of this level, because I create a lot of dance shows that are of a smaller scale, so to say. And then I had some people around me that were encouraging me, saying, you know, this is such an important story. You can really bring it to a large scale that, you know, could fill a stage of Place des Arts. And I was like, yeah, right. Ha ha. Right. So just, I think the first step was just me believing that I could do that, that I was worthy of and had the skills to create such a show of such scale. And of course I had a team. I didn't do it alone. Mm-hmm. So I ended up surrounding myself with people that were really good at supporting and guiding me in things that I might know. So that was a really big struggle, just trying to believe that. And it was a huge learning curve of getting to that scale of being able to create a show like that. It took 5 years. It would have been shorter, but then COVID hit and we had to put a lot of things on hold. Another part was really hard. There's one scene in the show, because after the men died on the bridge, the women were left alone, and then the church came in and convinced some of the women to give up their kids to residential school, mm-hmm. saying, you know, you can't take care of them, the breadwinner of the family isn't there anymore, so you should send your kids to these residential schools. It'd be better for them. And so some women did. So it was, you know, a double tragedy. They lost not only their husbands, but also their children to these awful places. And we had this, and we always knew it was a sad part of the story that we do tell, we do show on stage. But recently, because of there's been so many discoveries of the children's graves across Canada in residential schools, it added a new weight to that scene. And me and the dancers were really aware of that. So we had to sit down and talk like for hours and try to figure out like the most respectful and best way to tell this part of the story, being aware that people could be triggered in the audience. And even us, when we were like creating it, we'd have to stop and smudge and stop and cry. Or, you know, the woman who does the main dance in that, she actually uses her own daughter's clothes as part of that dance. So it really touches personally. But we have like support workers usually in the audience that will help people who are triggered. And so that was a really hard part to do. And I had to reach out to like the residential school survivors organization, for example, and ask their advice and their counsel. And they said, no, you got to do it. You got to tell this because it's going to help the survivors. It's going to help them, you know, realize it doesn't disappear, you know, behind other headlines. So, yeah, I guess those were some of the challenging parts.
Yeah, I think it's such an important story to tell as much as it is tragic. You kind of dived into how relevant it is in today's age. Do you think there are positive influences that your dance or your show will create on the world right now?
Well, that's always my hope. because, well, you know, like I said, for this particular story, the thing about art is it will touch people not only on an intellectual level, but also on an emotional level. And that makes it stronger. So I'm hoping that my dances, not only this, but other ones, touch people on those levels, emotional and intellectual, spiritual, if you want to say it even, that will make people understand our history more and therefore be able to help in the future. And it will inspire them to like to look more into our stories and our culture and our people and create bridges, create communication between each other. So yes, I really do believe that it can bring positiveness to everyone.
Thank you so much for diving into all this and your projects and sitting here with me today. So just to kind of end off, where can people find you and your work?
Well, I am in the process of creating a webpage, which isn't up yet, but for now you could find me on Facebook either under Barbara Dibo or Barbara Ganiraduni Dibo. I have two pages.
Perfect. So thank you for listening to John Abbott on the Air. Once again, I'm Marshall Dibo, and that was Indigenous dance artist Barbara Ganiraduni Dibo. Remember to continue to educate yourself about the Indigenous culture and make sure to support Indigenous artists. Nyawa Goa, and have a great rest of your day. Ona!
Maria Kerr here, and you're listening to CKUT's 90.3 FM. John Abbott on the air. Today's interview guest is Sarah Becerra. So, hey, Sarah. It's nice to have you here today.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Sarah here has been on two humanitarian trips, once in 2017 and the other in 2018. Tell us, Sarah, how long did your visits to Kenya actually last?
Well, the first one was initially supposed to be only 2 weeks, but it was just so great and I was just having the time of my life. So I decided to extend the trip to 1 month and a week. And the second one was 3 weeks long.
So you're saying that you enjoyed your time there, and what exactly did you end up doing?
We did various different activities. We hosted a youth convention, a 3-day convention. We had groups from all over. So we had a group from Ethiopia, a group from Tanzania. I don't remember the other countries, but there were groups from different countries around Kenya. And there was a 3-day convention, as I said, and we did a lot of games with them. We sung a lot of different songs in Swahili and in English, but it was mainly in Swahili. We learned songs in their own language over there. We did plays. We played different sports over there in the compound where we were, where the convention was at. And it was great. And we also did hospital visits. So we, it was around Christmas time. So we sung, we sang with them Christmas carols to cheer the patients up. We also did prison visitations. I went with a church-led organization. So there was a lot of preaching and stuff. It was, you know, for the main purpose of just spreading a message of hope and a message of love for the people. And regardless of their faith, whether they were, you know, whether Islam or Christianity, like, regardless of their faith, everyone was very accepting of the messages that were, you know, spread and stuff. And it was a lot of, you know, a little preaching, and then we, it was a lot of sharing with the family, just like talking with them, getting to know more about them and how, you know, they tell us about their lives and they tell us stories. And it just ends up being a lot of social time with the families. So it was families in different villages. We always had a translator with us everywhere we went. And, you know, in Nairobi, the capital, there's a lot of English speakers over there. You go to malls, you know, it's a lot of people speak English. But if you go more in the smaller villages, this is where you have different dialects and less English. So we had translators everywhere we went. And it was, we did a lot of hiking, you know, 5 a.m. hiking to see the sunrise, and a lot of nature. There's a lot, we actually visited the equator. We were standing on the equator, since Kenya is in the middle of the map. And yeah, we did a lot of different activities. It was the best, honestly. I chose Kenya once. And then the second time, I had the option of going elsewhere, but I chose Kenya again, and I would choose it again.
So you're saying that you were able to interact with many different people in different environments. So what would you say that the main differences were between people here and people who live in third world countries?
Wow, that's a very big question. A lot of differences. I feel like it's pretty hard to answer that question just because there's so much to say. But if I can make this, you know, very brief, if I can give you a brief answer and a small one, I would say the main difference is the view, our views on the world and on everything. Here we take everything for granted. We're very individualists and very self-absorbed mentality, if I may say. And over there, they, you know, they give thanks to everything, you know, regardless of their faith. They're just very thankful for everything they have and don't have, you know. These people are very at peace. A lot of them, I don't want to say at peace, because not everyone is, and we saw a lot of hardships, and a lot of these families were broken, you know, because of poverty. But yet in this poverty, there is something so peaceful in these people, and so they seem content. Content is the word. Yes, they seem content. I was with one of the families, and the father was telling us, "Hey, I heard you guys have houses for your cars." You know, speaking of the garage, and we're like, "Yeah, a garage." He's like, "Yes, and so you guys have houses for your cars, and you're still complaining and unhappy." And that really shook us, and it was there was this awkward silence right after, you know, he had said that. But He was right. And that's why it was really silent right after, because we take things for granted and we're always looking for more and wanting more and just never satisfied. They are very satisfied people and content with what they have. And it's something I wish we had more of.
Like, we're very materialistic.
Very materialistic, really. Yeah.
And they have, like, the bare minimum to survive.
Yeah.
A lot of them seem to be very happy in, like, because you showed me pictures before.
Yeah.
So they're very happy with what they have. And that's just a really beautiful thing to see that we don't really see it here. But I feel that it's something that they have that we don't. Yeah. Which is, like, the beauty of it.
And something that, you know, one thing that really had struck to me is that, you know, we were walking, and in the villages, to walk from one house to another, it's long walks, okay? So we were walking from one house to the other, and I was carrying 2 water bottles, and they were just so heavy, and I was so not down to pick them up, and I was complaining. I was just saying, I wish I had a backpack to just put everything in it instead of holding them in my hands, whatever, whatever. I was just complaining about nothing, you know? And to my right, there was this like, Kenyan child. She was, like, not more than 10 years old. She was carrying her little sibling on her back and walking barefoot on rocks. And she was so happy, and she was walking with a smile and walking as if so unbothered, and just, like, she's walking with a child on her back, barefoot, on rocks, while I'm complaining. I have shoes, and I'm complaining that I'm holding 2 heavy water bottles, and the amount of walking they have to do to get that water, you know, I just realized, like, why am I even complaining right now?
So what would you say, like, the biggest life lesson that you got from there that stuck with you is?
I got a lot of life lessons, but a main one would be my perspective really changed once I came here. I realized how materialistic we are, as you said. And I just didn't care about my phone. I was off social media when I came back, because over there we're not on social media. So I came back and I didn't care about my social media. I didn't open Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. I didn't care, you know. And so I even unlocked my phone and removed the password and didn't even care. I was like, if I lose my phone, someone steals it, I so didn't care about these, like, little things. Everything. I just realized how materialistic we are, and, you know, I just wasn't down for all the, the things that seemed so, I want, before I go on those kinds of trips, you come back and you're like, you realize the true value of these. It's just very, pretty irrelevant. Like, yes, I do need a phone to call my mom in case of an emergency, or, you know, but is it a need? Is it a real need? Would I survive without it? And then you come here and you realize I can survive with, like, a fraction of what I have. I don't need everything I have. You know what I'm saying? So I came back and I just realized, like, ugh, I don't need all these things, all that materialistic stuff. And everything just seemed so little and uninteresting, and I enjoyed so little, so much more. I enjoyed nature. Every time I come back from these trips, I just come back and enjoy nature so much more. And just a walk in the forest, a walk by the water is just so, that is what I really need. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you, Sarah, for sharing your experience on your 2 humanitarian trips to Kenya.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, I'm Maria Kerr, and you're listening to CKUT's 90.3 FM. John Abbott on the air.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the air. I'm Evie Stockvis. See you next time.
Happy birthday to you, first anniversaire, something music is there.